From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Because of his affinity for stray dogs, Ken Foster finds them everywhere, tied under park benches, stuck in drainage grates, and running door to door in the neighborhood with an eye out. On today's Fresh Air, Ken Foster tells us about the dogs he's rescued and found homes for, and his own dogs. He says his dogs have helped him through September 11th, when he lived close to the World Trade Center, a heart problem, and Hurricane Katrina. He moved to New Orleans just before it hit. Foster's new memoir is called The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us why we should be watching the final season of NBC's The West Wing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He doesn't go looking for stray dogs. The dogs find him, says my guest Ken Foster. He says they come up to him and sit at his feet. They tap him with a paw. They loiter in his path. And when they do, he tries to find them homes or take them to shelters. He lives with three dogs. Foster is a writer. Dogs are often his subject. He's written for Bark Magazine, McSweeney's, and The Believer, and edited the anthology Dog Culture. His new book is called The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from the Pets Who Were Left Behind. Last summer, just before Hurricane Katrina, Foster and his three dogs moved to New Orleans. As we'll hear later, they evacuated and are now back in the city, where he's been volunteering at the SPCA. Why do you feel a responsibility to stray dogs when you find them?
That's one of the questions I was trying to explore when I wrote the book, and I didn't really know the answer, I guess. I wanted to try to figure out what is it that compels me to actually do something, since there are so many people who, you know, don't seem to notice them or see them and hope somebody else is going to take care of it. I kind of wanted to figure out why why do I keep running into these dogs everywhere and instead of continuing on my way, taking them home. And I think one of the things I found, at least in myself, is, I guess, a number of things. But one of them is that it's so easy, really, to solve this problem of this little furry life that needs some direction, you know, that needs a place to go, that needs to be taken care of. And so why not do it? Why not help this animal out? The other thing that I talk about a lot in the book is the fact that so many things in our lives aren't under our control or don't seem to be. You know, fate plays a big part in our lives, and it plays a big part in what I write about in the book. And for a stray dog, we can actually change their life, and we can do it in an afternoon.
You have three dogs. Tell us the story behind how you found the first of those three, Brando.
Brando's like my soulmate in some strange way, although I hate to say that because it makes me sound a little bit crazy. But I'd actually been living in Costa Rica, and there was a dog there named Duque who followed me home every day after lunch and would take a nap and get up and then follow the gardener around the property and then come back for dinner and then guard my door while I slept at night. And it was the first dog that I fell completely in love with and really began to appreciate the things that a dog can sort of show you about the world, because they're always watching things. They're always attuned to things that we sort of filter out, I think. And I couldn't bring him back. The airline wouldn't let me. So I left him in the village with a huge bag of dog food for everyone to take care of him with. And yet when I came back to New York, I had fallen into this work pattern of having a dog in my life. And so I went on to Pet Finder and found this picture of a dog that didn't look anything like Duque, because I would feel guilty if I felt that I was replacing him. So it had to be a unique dog. And there was this little teeny tiny striped puppy that was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And so I went over to this shelter in Brooklyn called Bark and met this little dog named Brando. And I visited him every day for a week, actually, to make sure that we liked each other. And then I put him in a hired car and drove him across the river to Manhattan to my apartment there. And we've been together ever since. But what I didn't realize was he had been abandoned on the street as a puppy, and he had really bad separation anxiety, which I'd always heard about, but I didn't really understand how severe it can be. So there were many months of dealing with this hysteria every time I left him in the apartment, and self-destructive behavior. My neighbors actually thought that I'd purchased a bird of some kind, because the noises he made when I was gone were like a high-pitched sort of shrilling, you know, parrot or something.
Some of the advice that you took when you got Brando was to keep Brando in a crate, in a cage, while you were gone for the day at work. And he ended up chewing through three or four crates. Sometimes, and once you came home and found, tell us the worst that had happened.
I came home one day and he had there are a couple worse things, actually. I came home one day and he had eaten my razor blades. And I found the handles of disposable razor blades scattered throughout the house with no blades left in them. And obviously he'd been watching me shave every morning before I left him and made some kind of association with this object and me. There was another time that I came home and he had gotten into the trash and bit into a can of dog food that was stuck in his mouth. And one time, actually, after September 11th, I left him in his crate and the TV was on and the president came on to give some kind of address. And when I got back, he had gotten out of the crate, unplugged the television, dragged it into his crate, gotten into a pile of the New York Times, which he shredded and stuffed into the crate about a foot deep. And I thought it was some kind of commentary on the media coverage of our situation. but really, I mean, I also was worried because he was, you know, he was doing these things that clearly could hurt him.
So with Brando, because he had abandonment issues, you briefly put him on medication?
Yeah, he's been on medication a couple of times, actually. Mm-hmm. But there's a medication called Clomacom, which is the only FDA-approved medication to treat separation anxiety in dogs, which, I mean, it's kind of amazing that such a thing exists. But, you know, the problem with separation anxiety apparently is fairly widespread, so much so that the FDA is, you know, approving medication for it. And it eventually calms him down. It's a psychotropic drug, I guess, which builds up in the system and keeps sort of the extreme behavior from occurring. It's used to treat obsessive compulsive disorder as well, which of course separation anxiety is an extension of, the fact that everyone needs to be here now and never leave the room. And when the separation anxiety has been its most intense when he was a puppy, if we were walking on the street and sat and talked to someone for a few minutes, he would become hysterical when they walked away. So it wasn't even just about me. It was about anybody who entered into his life for any period of time. He just wanted to collect people and never let them go, you know?
You've described your dog Brando as your soulmate. Why do you think of him that way? What makes him your soulmate?
I think because we've been through so many things together at this point. You know, he was with me in New York on September 11th and after that. And I write in the beginning of my book, I talk about how, you know, there are all these things that we try to block out of our lives or our consciousness, or things that we try to be sort of coldly efficient about going about our business. And one of those things, I think, is grieving. And in those days after, and months after, really, September 11th, he would stop me all the time. If we were passing a memorial on the street, he would sit down in front of it. And in doing that, I think he, you know, he forced me to slow down. He forced me to recognize the loss all around us. And so, I mean, we're so attuned through that experience, I think. You know, early in the morning, because we lived downtown below 14th Street, for months afterwards, when they were, you know, pulling the wreckage out of there, there were fires that would light up again. And I would wake up in the morning and he would be crying. And on mornings when he was crying first thing in the morning, I knew that in a couple hours I'd be able to smell it too. And so we have this experience where, you know, nobody else shared that with me during those days except him. And then, you know, later with my heart situation that I write about in the book and Hurricane Katrina, I feel like we have like a shared memory of this very intense 5 years of my life.
Now, you've had a couple of pretty serious health crises. One was that you broke your clavicle and you were out of commission for a while. And another was that you had serious heart problems and you needed a pacemaker and you needed a long period of rest. So you not only needed people to help you during those two health crises, you needed people to help your dogs. So in a time like that, when you're temporarily out of commission, is it a real burden to have the dogs?
No. a sort of emphatic no. And you would think it would be in the, obviously there are considerations you need to make. But particularly with the pacemaker, for months I was exhausted and I would sleep for days at a time. I even told friends that I was sleeping like a dead man. And I didn't realize that I literally was sleeping like a dead man. Because my heart had dropped down to a pulse of about 30 or 35. And that was when I was awake. So when I was sleeping, it was going even lower. And again, I always talk about how intuitive dogs are and how much we could learn by observing how they observe things and how they pay attention. I just chose to ignore all these signs and continued lethargically going about my business for months while my dogs became more and more frantic around me because they knew something was wrong. And my Rottweiler, who is the most well-behaved dog ever, you know, I will nominate her for every dog award there is. She never comes into the bed unless she's invited. And I would wake up in the morning and she was sitting on my chest.
Like she knew something was wrong with your heart?
Yeah. And at the time I just thought, how strange. And of course it was extremely strange for her to be doing that. But she knew something was not allowing me to wake up, I think is what she knew. And so she was sitting on me to get me up. And when I came back from getting the pacemaker implanted, every time I sat down, she would come over and press her ear to my chest. So she knew that something had been fixed, that something that didn't sound right before sounded the way it was supposed to now.
Yeah, let me mention your heart situation. You needed a pacemaker and basically had to stop completely for a while you recovered from your heart ceasing to function temporarily. And then with Katrina, you evacuated with your three dogs. So you know, Brenda went through Hurricane Katrina with you. You were living in New Orleans. You'd moved there just before the hurricane. Now, did your dogs affect your sense of what you should do when you knew that the hurricane was coming?
Yes. I, like so many other people, I wasn't planning to leave. In fact, the afternoon of the hurricane, I was sitting at a wine tasting with a bunch of friends, and everyone was talking about what they were going to do to prepare for the hurricane that probably wasn't really coming. And since my friends and I were all teachers, we were a little bit upset because we figured even if the storm didn't come, we would probably not have class Monday and we'd have to redo our lesson plans. And then I went online and there was a map of the predicted flooding that would occur if the storm was as bad as they thought it could be. And it didn't look like my street necessarily was going to flood, but basically everything else around us would. And I just thought, I can put myself in a situation where I might need to wade to safety or swim, but I can't do that to my dogs. So I woke up early. It wasn't even light out. Went and got gas. Put the dogs in the car, put their crates in the car, put dog food in the car, grabbed a couple of bottles of wine that I thought I would drink with a friend in Mississippi while we waited for the storm to pass. And I had one change of clothes for myself, and that's what I left with, thinking still that I'd be back in a day, and of course we weren't.
No, but you are back now, and your home was not destroyed. A lot of rats in it, I understand. But I think
yeah,
that was
it was pretty much intact, and but I also was worried because there could be wind damage or anything like that. So when I came back, I loaded up the car as if I was going camping, because I thought I may end up camping in whatever is standing where we used to live. And yet I came in, and the electricity for my house was already back on. This was in October. So it was, 6 weeks later, but still far earlier than for many people. The electricity was on. There were rats that had come out of the water and lived in my house and gotten into a lot of things. There was a small hole in the roof towards the back, and yet, all of those things seemed like nothing compared to what everyone else had to deal with. So we came back and we sort of investigated the neighborhood for the first couple of days to see what had happened. And actually, one of the strange things was that there was a warehouse a few blocks away from us that had caught on fire, and they'd been storing propane tanks inside that went shooting all over the neighborhood like rockets and basically obliterated this warehouse. But the smell in the air, that combination of fuel and cement, was exactly the smell from September 11th. And again, walking the neighborhood with Brando, there was a sense that we both recognized that familiar sort of disaster smell.
My guest is Ken Foster. His new book is called The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're going to take a brief break here to ask for your financial support so that your station will continue to be here for you. Thank you. My guest is Ken Foster. His new book about rescuing dogs is called The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. You've been volunteering at the SPCA in New Orleans. What can you do as a volunteer? What do you do?
Well, because I love pit bulls, and so many of the dogs in any shelter, if they even allow pit bulls in, are pit bulls. So many of the dogs that are abandoned are pit bulls. The pit bull makes up a huge percentage of the population across the country of dogs, actually. And yet they're really, really sweet in spite of what people may be told. So I've been playing with the pit bulls, basically, and taking them for walks. And in some cases, we sit and read to them because they're too shy to even come to the door of their cage to go out for a walk yet. So people have been sitting and reading books to them, and eventually they edge their way closer to you. And one of the volunteers insists that they prefer Harry Potter. But I've been mostly just telling them stories that I invent as I'm sitting with them.
And the idea is that just your human voice will be kind of soothing?
Human voice and being
socializing.
Close to someone who's... Uh-huh. Yes, human voice and being close to someone who's talking to them and talking to them in a calm voice that they get used to it. It doesn't frighten them anymore because obviously... their experience in the past has been that humans are frightening.
You mentioned that after Katrina, the majority of lost or homeless dogs were pit bulls. Is there a reason for that? Is there an explanation for that?
I think part of it is that the pit bull population is much larger than people realize. And in fact, a lot of people don't really know what a pit bull is. When I have a pit bull named Sula that I, for a while was trying to find a home for, and people would always meet her and be completely charmed by her and say, what kind of dog is this? And when I told them it was a pit bull, suddenly they would back away, whereas before they were kissing her and and she was kissing them back. So there's a huge pit bull population to begin with, and I think a lot of people get a pit bull because they have the reputation of being a fierce dog. And then when they discover that it isn't a fierce dog, that it's not going to scare people away, or that it's not going to fight, they'll throw it away. Also, in this case, people who might have lived in poor neighborhoods might have had a dog that they used as both a pet and as security, and those are the same people who didn't have a way out of town. So they didn't have a way of bringing the animal with them, and therefore they were among the ones left behind. I remember it was such a strange experience to be evacuated and to be in this sort of limbo that we were all in, and to read and see coverage of the situation with the people that were left behind and the animals. But there was one photograph in particular in the New York Times of a house that was on the verge of collapse, and in the attic, which was partially ripped open, there was a pit bull sitting waiting for its owner to come home. And that just haunted me.
There's three cities in the United States, Denver, Cincinnati, and Miami, that have bans on pit bulls. And Denver has actually put at least a couple of hundred pit bulls to death. And this is because of, you know, statistics that pit bulls are the dog most likely to attack. Is that it?
You know, if you really look at the statistics behind dog attacks, what you find that each attack has in common, regardless of whether it's a pit bull or some other kind of dog, is that they have an incredibly irresponsible or abusive owner. You'll find they have histories of previous animal violations, of criminal activity, of abuse of other humans, of abuse of minors. And yet none of these things are ever addressed. And it worries me, not just for these dogs who I love, but also for the way that we seem to think that we can solve problems in this country by rubber stamping weird sorts of legislation, that rather than addressing the human behavior and the human irresponsibility behind these isolated attacks with individual dogs, we think the solution is to ban them outright and to put them to sleep. I'd rather that we focused our energy on dealing with the humans who are being irresponsible than the dogs.
Ken Foster will be back in the second half of the show. His new book is called The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rescuing Valentino and other pit bulls. We continue our conversation with Ken Foster, author of The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Were Left Behind. And TV critic David Bianculli doesn't want you to miss the final episodes of The West Wing.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From GM, with 1.5 million flex-fuel vehicles on the road that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ken Foster, author of the book The Dogs Who Found Me, What I've Learned from Pets Who Are Left Behind. It's a memoir about rescuing dogs and trying to find homes for them. Foster has an affinity for pit bulls. He says that whenever he sees one wandering along a road, he pulls his car over and invites the dog in. Pit bulls are probably the breed most likely to be abandoned and are particularly hard to place because they have a reputation for attacking. Three cities, Denver, Cincinnati, and Miami, have bans on pit bulls. But Foster thinks pit bulls are good dogs. Now, from what I understand about pit bulls, they've basically been bred to be tough fighting dogs with really strong jaws and strong muscles. So do you think that the problem is the way the dogs were bred, or do you think the problem is that owners who want, you know, kind of tough, macho, mean dogs tend to choose pit bulls, and that some of those owners, you know, try to train the dogs to be really mean and tough?
Any dog that isn't socialized is going to get mean and tough. And some of the most vicious dogs I've known have been tiny little lap dogs who I think sometimes by virtue of their tininess, people think they don't need to train them or socialize them properly. But I think the problem with pit bulls, in some cases, there may be dogs that are bred to be more aggressive. There may be certain bloodlines that are potentially more aggressive. And yet, even those dogs, even the dog fighter wants a dog that might be aggressive in a fighting ring with another dog, but not aggressive to another human, because nobody wants to get bit. And if you look at, you know, New York City has a population of 300 to 350,000 pit bulls. You never hear about them going on any kind of crazy rampage through the city, mauling people. You know, there's some other cities where, for some reason, it seems like it is a little bit more common. And yet, again, if you look at the actual incidents and the behavior surrounding the dog and the way the dog is housed and the way the dog has been trained or not trained, I think that's the statistic that we need to look at, and that's the behavior we need to address. The dog itself has been around, you know, for a long, long time and has frequently been used as a family dog, as a nanny dog. If you go back and look in the 30s, it was used in advertising for white bread and for children's shoes. Buster Brown is a pit bull. The Little Rascals dog Petey is a pit bull. And so, I mean, one of the things I actually hope to do in another book is to look at what happened to the pit bull and the way it's been used and abused, and including the way it's used in the media, the way the image of a pit bull has moved from being something that would sell a loaf of bread to something that is used, you know, to frighten people or to show machismo or to describe a really tough lawyer or, you know, what does it say about us as a society that we've taken this dog from one extreme to another?
Since you feel an affinity for pit bulls and since you've rescued a lot of pit bulls and you have a couple of pit bulls, when you see a stray pit bull on the street, how do you approach it, knowing that this dog might be really tough, might be mean, on the other hand, might not be, but it's going to be strong probably one way or another. So how do you cautiously approach a stray pit bull?
You know, in the book, I tell the story of Valentino, who is a dog, a pit bull, an 85-pound pit bull that I found in a gas station. And yet, the reason I approached him, and I approached him, and not only approached him, but also climbed over an embankment to essentially chase him, to get a hold of him, which I say in the book, do not do this at home, essentially. You know, don't chase a dog, don't climb over an embankment, don't grab him by the collar. All of these are things you should not do. And yet, in that case, I did do them. Because you could tell from his body language that he was a good dog. He was very, very, he was sitting outside the gas station and following people to their cars and sitting outside their car while they got into their car and waiting to see if they might invite him into their car. And even a pit bull, for the most part, I mean, anything's possible, I guess. But most dogs, they give a warning before they attack. Even a dog that might have aggression problems, they're going to give a warning before they attack. Because what they really want you to do is just to back away. And I think if you just pay attention to that body language in an animal, you know whether you feel comfortable approaching it or not. And I always tell people, dogs pick up on whether you are nervous or whether you're comfortable or uncomfortable around them. And if you're not comfortable, don't go near the dog. Call somebody else, you know.
Considering the story of Valentino, you did rescue him, you put him in your car, but instead of putting him in the back of the car where you have a cage, he was in the front seat with you, and what happened?
Yeah, it was yet another example of what not to do. One of the things I sat down and thought about before I started working on the book was that, you know, I don't consider myself an expert on anything, really. But I thought, well, maybe people can learn by everything I've done wrong. And Valentino leaned over first, and then he stepped on top of me, and then he climbed on top of me and sat down facing me. So I couldn't see where I was driving, and he's staring at me, you know, eye to eye. And I have to say, I thought, what have I done? But then he just started kissing me all over. Big, slobbery tongue. And I said to him, because I still couldn't see where I was going on the highway, and I said, you know, you need to get back in your seat. And he got back in his seat and sat down and stayed in that seat for the rest of the trip. I mean, he was an amazing, amazing dog. And yet I was really worried because most shelters, or many shelters at least, would not even take him in if he's a pit bull. They might take him in and put him immediately to sleep, but they're not going to try to find a home for him. And he was such a terrific dog. And I, you know, in the book, I tell the story of some of the complications I had in making sure he found a home. But he did and lived and continues to live happily ever after in a home with another dog that he lets climb on top of him. So he's a fine dog.
How did you find a home for him?
What happened was I'd given my name to the shelter that he was at and said to call if they needed to get rid of him. And I was hoping that that wouldn't happen. Of course, what I've realized now is that anytime you give an animal shelter your name and tell them to call if they need to get rid of a dog, they will call you. So they called and said that I needed to come get him. And I was living in Florida at the time. The dog was in New Orleans. A student in my classroom volunteered to go, a very tiny, petite girl who drove to New Orleans, a six-hour trip one way, picked this dog up that she'd never seen before in her life and drove back to Florida with him. And by the time she got home, she said, I'm keeping him. And I was still a little skeptical, so I dropped by about a week later to visit her and her other dog and Valentino in his new home. And it was clear that he'd found his home. And it was a little difficult, and it always is, to sort of realize that my role in the dog's life is done and I need to step aside. But that's what I did.
You've said that, you know, you rescued dogs, but in some ways you feel like the dogs have rescued you. From what?
I think from my heart situation, because what actually got me up out of my chair and sent me to a clinic where I thought maybe they would tell me I had some kind of respiratory infection was the dogs. The fact that, you know, they were sitting all around me, very close, staring at me. Sula kept climbing into my lap and licking my nose in a way that just seemed strange, as if she could smell something. And I thought maybe she smelled a respiratory infection because I was feeling a little short of breath. And if I'd been living alone, I probably would have just, you know, I hate to say this, but I would have been one of those people who went to bed one night and didn't wake up.
Do you mean emotionally, too, that the dogs have rescued you?
Well, I think so, too. I think I'm so much more in touch with my... It feels strange to say more in touch with my emotions because of my dogs. You know, it sounds like, you know, crazy dog talk. But I think because they've made me appreciate life and being alive and so many of the aspects of the world around us that I chose to ignore before, I think that that's tied into my emotional life in a way that I'm much more honest than I ever was before. I'm much less concerned about superficial things. I don't think I could have, even though the book is obviously about dogs and what I've learned from them, I don't think I would have been capable of writing this book or of learning these things or of communicating them in the way that I do if not for the dogs.
Well, Ken Foster, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ken Foster is the author of the new book, The Dogs Who Found Me. Let's listen to a great record by Gene Pitney. He was found dead in his hotel room yesterday at the age of 65 after performing in Wales the night before. Pitney had a big and expressive voice. His hits in the early 60s included Town Without Pity, Liberty Valance, Only Love Can Break a Heart, 24 Hours from Tulsa, and It Hurts to Be in Love. Here's his big 1961 hit, Town Without Pity. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli wants you to watch the final episodes of The West Wing. This is Fresh Air. After 7 years on TV, The West Wing comes to an end next month. TV critic David Bianculli says he doesn't want to wait until then to discuss the show because lately it's simply been too good to ignore.
When The West Wing premiered in 1999, in the previous century just before the premiere of The Sopranos, it instantly was the best drama series on television. Creator Aaron Sorkin took a potentially dry and wonky subject, the inner workings of the most powerful inner circle in politics, and made it funny, gripping, thought-provoking, even exciting. If you want to see how easily such a topic can go south, watch ABC's Commander-in-Chief, which is about to return. But if you want to watch a perfect dramatic TV series, get the DVDs and watch the first 2 seasons of The West Wing. The fictional world of The West Wing has a political cycle 2 years ahead of or behind our own. The story began with Martin Sheen's President Bartlet having 2 years to go in his first term. He ran for re-election and won in 2002, and we got to see his devoted, passionate staffers plan and fight his campaign, weather a scandal about his hidden health problems, and deal with one global or domestic crisis after another. But in Bartlett's second term, the West Wing became a little less focused and substantially less satisfying. After Sorkin left the show, and even in the final year while he was there, the West Wing didn't crackle the way it used to. Characters began to do things that were wildly uncharacteristic and totally unbelievable. Richard Schiff's Toby got into a fistfight, for example, when his strongest weapons always have been his intellect and his mouth. But a funny thing happened as the West Wing approached the final year of the final Bartlett term. Executive producer John Wells and company had to decide what to do next, and they gave their familiar characters divided loyalties. Some stayed with the White House. Others quit to work for the campaigns of various Democratic candidates, including two former vice presidents established in previous seasons of the show. Josh Lyman, played by Bradley Whitford, handpicked his own candidate and persuaded him to run. Matt Santos, a Latino congressman played by Jimmy Smits. And as Santos very slowly evolved, Jimmy Carter-like, from dark horse joke to improbable Democratic frontrunner, the West Wing also introduced his formidable Republican opponent, California Senator Arnold Vinnick, played by Alan Alda. This was brilliant casting on both sides, adding to a concept that was genius in the first place. Instead of focusing on one side of the campaign, as the West Wing had done 4 years before, it now showed us both. It even brought back Ron Silver as a strategist hired by Bartlett for his campaign, now working for Vinnick and the Republicans. Shows alternated between showcasing Vinnick and Santos, or offered equal time to both. There's no question that the quality of the shows improved once the writers saw what Smits and Alda were capable of doing. These were the sorts of candidates you wanted to vote for. And when the West Wing staged a live debate, Smits and Alda walked into that high-pressure arena and killed. Not each other, just as actors. The cop from NYPD Blue and the doctor from MASH have found, later in their careers, roles that good, and they've responded accordingly. These fictional campaigns have gotten the details right, from the earliest days stumping for votes door-to-door in the Iowa caucus to the current election day tension and last-minute maneuvering. As the climax to a long-running story, that would be plenty, but reality threw a tragic curve into the mix this season. John Spencer, who played Leo McGarry, former White House chief of staff and the current vice presidential running mate of Matt Santos, died suddenly. This Sunday's episode begins as last week's ended. Only a couple of hours are left until the polls close in the West on Election Day, and the race still is too close to call. Red states and blue states all over the map, all boiling down to a fight for the one still in white, undecided. That's when Santos gets the news that Leo has collapsed in his hotel room and been hospitalized. Santos reacts one way, but his entourage, including his deputy campaign manager, played by Janine Garofalo, and his wife, played by Terry Polo, have other ideas.
Where is he?
They're taking him to Methodist. The ambulance should be there by now.
Where's Josh?
He just left for the hospital.
Was Leo talking?
We don't know.
Should we be going to the hospital?
No, press doesn't have this yet.
Why not?
Polls out west are open for another 90 minutes. The longer that we...
You want to try and keep this a secret for an hour and a half?
A quarter of the country is still voting.
And I'm asking all four quarters to trust me to be their leader. I am not hiding the health problems of my vice president.
It may not be the best place to have this conversation.
Anything that highlights any
uncertainty... I am not having this conversation. We're issuing a statement to the press now.
Congressman, this is still a campaign, and there's only two kinds, the pitiless and the dead. Every minute we stand here, votes are being cast. Undecideds vote late in the day. If they were looking for a reason to vote Vinnick, a press release from us could just punch their lottery ticket.
It's going to come out. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, the paramedics, somebody at the hotel or the hospital is going to say something.
Maybe we get lucky and it takes an hour for the press to confirm and get something on
the air.
They're
not going to wait to confirm it. They're going to go with the rumor.
I know he's your friend. He's my friend, too. But we can't be sentimental about this or we will have a Republican president who will gut education, he will auction off Social Security, and cut taxes till we're bleeding red ink. And when Leo wakes up, he will kick your ass for letting that happen. You know he will.
What does Santos decide to do? That's revealed on Sunday. So is the winner of the election, but I won't spoil the suspense by saying anything here. When a show is this good, you really should see for yourself. And The West Wing, in its final year, has returned to the fabulous form of its first. It's earned a renewal, but isn't getting one. So the least we can do is support the series and applaud it as it goes out in glory.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. The West Wing airs Sunday night on NBC. This is Fresh Air. Your station is fundraising today. There's a direct correlation between this fundraising break and your continued ability to listen to Fresh Air. Your station has to pay a fee to broadcast our show. That's the way it works with most national programs on public radio. That fee helps us produce the program. So your station has to raise enough money during Fresh Air to cover that fee. I really hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you. At a time when hip-hop dominates the R&B scene, it's often easier for a rapper to achieve commercial success than a singer. Rock critic Ken Tucker examines why that is in his review of two new albums by R&B vocalists, Jaheim's Ghetto Classics and Van Hunt's On the Jungle Floor.
I done stood out on the block, 12 o'clock, still pitching. I done broke up bricks with baking soda in the kitchen. I done lost my religion and spent nights wishing I could fill up the hole in my soul with something missing. I done sat back and laughed and left the beef unfold. Done scores off triggers, robbed niggas and stone. 5 years parole, kid, I've been locked up. I done lost so much, my heart is boxed up.
Jaheim's presumptuously titled Ghetto Classics tries hard to please fans of old-fashioned R&B slow jams and devotees of more rough-style vocalizing. The New Jersey native sounds as though he listened hard to nearby Philadelphia acts like Teddy Pendergrass and Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. But he also invites rappers to cameo on his album in an effort to keep it real, that is, to root his romancing in the tough attitude of the streets. The result is a song like Fiend, which commences with a spoken word intro by the rapper Styles P, and amidst the lush string section contains the refrain, I'm just an addict for your love.
She helped me focus in, get my rhymes right tuned, and my mind right tuned, that's why she shines through.
I gotta quit, I gotta get this chick about my system, she's no good for me. All of my dogs wanna hit her, right after her with her, I eat then I fall asleep. And it's getting costly. Lately, all I've been bagging is them chicks that come with seeds. Well, shorty, she's a dime. In fact, that girl's a dub. And I think I'm falling in love. She gets me.
Jaheim, in trying to prove that he can be both a burly love man and a rock hard street player, has created a very interestingly strained album. It doesn't so much lurch between R&B and hip hop as it tries for a synthesis that he can only rarely pull off for an entire song. He's trying for some amalgamation that could prove original. On the other hand, Van Hunt's new sophomore album, On the Jungle Floor, is frequently one big game of name that impersonation. For example, think of Curtis Mayfield singing Superfly. Got it in your head? Okay, now listen to Van Hunt singing this song called Character.
Faces have trouble smiling when it's less than a merry affair. When you communicate through the writing on the wall, there's no love for you there. You wanted to draw a picture, but your relationship could never hold a pose. You're left with a room full of sketches that only hint at the love you wanted to know. Let it out, let it.
Pretty dead on Curtis Mayfield, right? Okay, how about this? Is it late period Sly Stone or is it Van Hunt?
Sister! Child of mine.
sweetest kind, yeah. Drugs and death in a place in time, restless and running.
Actually, as a Sly Stone rip, that's a really entertaining tune. Even more intriguing, it's actually a cover of a song by the proto-punk band The Stooges. But Van Hunt is also capable of some original, novel inspiration. He comes up with some really nice effects when he modulates his voice, shifting upward into the chorus of Being a Girl.
Every once in a while you meet a child that drives you wild. What a mistake.
What it comes down to with both Jaheim and Van Hunt is their social and musical dilemma. To make music that displays vulnerability and softness, at a time when most of your potential audience prizes stoic pride and macho, you have to convince young consumers that sometimes it takes a very mighty man to let his shy side come through.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Ghetto Classics by Jaheim and On the Jungle Floor by Van Hunt. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember the great alto saxophonist Jackie McLean. He died last week at the age of 74. We'll listen back to an interview with him about his life and music and the things he learned from Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and Charles Mingus. Join us for the next Fresh Air.